Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor, and for more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with several of the editors from The Mandalorian, specifically the editors of the 4 episodes that were nominated for Emmys for Outstanding Single-Camera Picture Editing for a Drama Series. These editors are Dylan Fershine and Eric Jessen, who edited Chapter 11, The Heiress; Andrew S. Eisen, ACE, who edited Chapter 13, The Jedi; Jeff Sibenek, who edited Chapter 15, The Believer; and Adam Christel, who edited Chapter 16, The Rescue. Dylan Fershine was a first assistant editor on Solo, a Star Wars story. He's been an associate or additional editor on projects like Tron Legacy and Valkyrie, and was editor on the feature film This Is Happening. Eric Jessen has edited features including Holmes and Watson and the TV series Allegiance. He was an additional or associate editor on John Carter and Where the Wild Things Are. Prior to that, he'd worked as an assistant editor on films like Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow and X-Men Days of Future Past. Andrew Eisen has cut films like The Imitation Game and The House with a Clock in Its Walls and Guardians of the Galaxy Inferno. He was an additional editor on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and an associate editor on The Hateful Eight. Jeff Sibenek was an editor on TV series including Cobra Kai, Dead Inside, Eastbound and Down, Parks and Rec, and the pilot of Young Sheldon. He's also cut features The Legacy of a White-Tailed Deer and Cardboard Boxer, among others. Adam Gristel edited the 2019 film The Lion King, Transformers The Last Knight, was a second editor on The Jungle Book, and a previs editor on Star Trek Into Darkness. We've selected scenes that you can watch for each of these episodes, so if you're interested in seeing those scenes and reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. So that you can try to put a voice with a name, I'll ask each of them to introduce themselves. One of my first questions is, I think everybody knows, who's a fan of the show or who knows about the production of the show, a lot of it is shot on this thing called The Volume. What do you think the ramifications of that in post? What's the benefit or what are some of the challenges?
Not exactly in post, but in pre, it forces us to have a complete previs cut because the volume has to be planned out weeks in advance and they have to have those backgrounds completely rendered out.
Which they're built and designed and rendered in a game engine, like a video game engine. So it's all 3D and it works with the cameras and the mocap so that when the camera moves, the backgrounds shift in the screen. It's like a big 3D virtual background.
And when we get our footage back, we basically, it looks like dailies that were shot on location. Yeah, ultimately for us, that's how it looks. So there's a lot less blue screen or imagining that we have to do when we get our footage back. And same for the actors on the set.
And in terms of prepping it, because of the volume, it gives the opportunity for us to be a part of the process as early as previs, where usually are the picture editors involved heavily in the editing and the previs, but that's not the case with Mandalorian. We're actually on from even as early back as we start with storyboards and animatic cuts, moving into previs in prep for shoot, so that a lot of story, script, blocking, pacing, rhythm issues are actually started to be solved during the previs phase in pre-production.
And it's also easy, well, not easy, but it's quick to maybe get a reshoot. I remember the Jawa shoot on season one. They're able to quickly just put up the background and get something quickly.
But I remember there was a day on season two where we had 3 or 4 different episodes all shooting that day of pickups. And they were just changing the background between episode.
It's fun to watch.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing on this show, though, because Jon Favreau has a very interesting philosophy. And I think one of the ways he's able to keep the show feeling real and feeling like it was shot in the 70s as opposed to, 2020 or 2021, is that he doesn't mind little imperfections. So if there was a mismatch in lighting or even a shadow, he kind of almost embraces that, especially where visual effects are concerned, because he doesn't want things to look so perfectly smooth and, fitting together. He wants it to feel like, oh, we were really there. And that's part of what intrinsically makes the show feel real, even though it's a very subconscious, thing.
The Star Wars franchise is well known for using wipes as transitions. The Mandalorian continues that tradition. Is there a rule about using them?
You know, I started using the wipes the very, 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 very first thing that I ever cut on the show, which was Previz episode 101. It was just one of those things that, like, it's part of Star Wars. It just happens. And now it's like they've written them into the script. And we use wipes to sort of transition between locations and times. It's basically instead of a dissolve or a passage of time is what we use a wipe for.
They don't dictate what kind of wipes and not always where. Sometimes we can just sort of decide to put them in and then they either stay or they don't. They usually just stay.
Yeah, usually. I don't think there was any that we took out. It was just what felt right in the assembly. And it kind of
there's never been a note on a wipe.
How were episodes chosen for submission consideration?
They asked us which ones we felt was our, you know, we wanted to showcase for ourselves.
What were some of the things that you felt were Emmy worthy that you chose this episode as the episode you wanted to submit?
I picked the rescue because of the challenges involved with the cross-cutting of multiple different storylines all trying to meet up and trying to shape a reveal at the end, where it's not supposed to be the climax of the episode, but yet is a big moment. And there were a lot of editing challenges to make all of that work together. So it felt like a thing that I worked hard at.
It's tough making that decision because you do have multiple shows. They're all your babies. You worked equally as hard on all of them. In my particular case, I mean, I loved The Tragedy, which was directed by Robert Rodriguez, you know, where the baby is brought to the rock, the baby's kidnapped. I mean, it's tragic. And it was wonderful. As far as the Jedi, it had a very unique style. It had a, you know, Dave Filoni, who was the director, chose to channel Akira Kurosawa a lot. We were really looking at style and Japanese style and the look and everything. And that dictated how the editing went as well. And there was also a lot of cross-cutting between stories and that. So altogether, it just felt like the right one that I would, for me to sort of put out there, just because it, in a way, it's different and it didn't even stand out a little bit.
Chapter 12, The Siege, which was another one that I cut season two, it was very intensive in post because that episode changed so much, so many times from previz to production. We saw the previz cut and then we changed it drastically. And then they shot that script and then they saw it and thought different ideas would be better for this and leading into the other episodes. So they ended up reshooting a whole chunk of the second half of the episode, which also kind of had to seamlessly interweave with the beginning and the middle. And they reshot an inch. Long story short, there was a lot of fancy footwork that took place on that episode. But at the end of the day, nobody would ever know that except for us because it plays so seamlessly and it's a great, exciting episode. But that's not what I wanted to put up on screen. It's like, well, I did a lot of work on it. Well, you know, so did everybody. The one I chose, which was 207, I liked that scene between Hess and Mando and Bill Burr playing Mayfeld because it's a time when I get to cut faces and performances and build tension between subtext and dialogue. And then also the intercutting with the action of them escaping and going off on the ledge and all that stuff. And I thought that was really fun because that took a lot of creativity and collaboration to get that all to feel as good as it does.
When you guys vote on editing nominations, what are some of the things that you look for when you are trying to judge Ace Eddies or Emmys or Oscars?
Funny, editing is so hard to judge, right? Because it's like you don't know, like we were just saying, you don't know what was involved in the editing room. And it's kind of hard to separate editing and directing. The two go hand in hand. But I'd say it's where the performances meld. It's where you almost forget about the editing, I think, is the ones that are the most successful.
Yeah, it's easy to see bad edits.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to judge good ones because it's absolutely invisible.
For me, when I'm going down the list of nominees or potential nominees, you tend to gravitate towards those shows, A, that you're familiar with, and hopefully you've watched as many of them as you can. And then the ones that resonated most with you, really, emotionally and all that, because you have to assume that there was something really well done in the process, hopefully the editing, that brought you in. For whatever reason, whether it made you laugh, whether it made you cry, whether it made you just, you know, be glued to the screen. You're not sitting there next to them. You don't really know what went into it. So you have to judge it on the merits of the show itself a lot of times.
There's so many great shows out there this year that I personally feel guilty that our show got so many nominations. But at the same time, you know, what I think is somewhat unique about our show is that the directors stay on for much longer than a traditional TV show. I can't speak to like how Game of Thrones and those other epic shows worked, but you know, I've worked on network television shows and you get less than a week for an assembly and a handful of days with the director. But on this show, you know, the directors are on for previs and obviously shooting and in post, well into post. I mean, and even into like visual effects reviews, it's that last, 5% that makes the show, and they're there for that.
You touched on it, Eric. It's like we're making individual movies. Like each one is treated as if it's a feature film. And from the very beginning process all the way to the end. And I'd worked on films with John before Mando, and the process that we did with animatics and animation, how we vet previs and before we shoot, was all the same. That I felt like we were making a movie. It just happened to be a 40-minute movie, but it was still a movie.
It is quite a process. It's not like you can't churn out 22 episodes in a season.
Many of the directors were also writers of the episodes. Are there challenges or advantages to working with a director who is also a writer?
I think The Jedi was written by Dave Filoni and directed by Dave Filoni. This character, Ahsoka Tano, that Dave wrote for The Jedi and reintroduced her into this into the live action world, was a baby of his since, the Clone Wars. He created this character with George Lucas. I think he'd been dreaming for a long time about bringing her to life. So during season one, when we were cutting one of the episodes together that he'd also written and directed, he was talking a lot about this, what's next year, what is this big episode next year, and then he would tell me the whole story. And it was very different a year before we actually made it. The script evolved a lot, but he put a lot of care and passion into that script. And so he knew what he wanted more than, let's say, a director for hire in terms of how the character was going to behave and act and look and everything. So it was really mapped out.
I noticed the episodes are all slightly different lengths. Was there any boundaries about length, or was it just like we're making the episode that is the right length for the story?
I don't remember any parameters. It was whatever feels right.
There's never been a discussion about length. It's only whether or not it feels too long or it feels too short.
Right. It's all content. It's like, is the story working? Just like on a movie, we're not trying to hit a number, which is really nice to not have to, it's got to be 22 minutes, whatever that is.
None of the directors or producers are very precious about things. When they watch it, they're watching it with the eyes of a viewer. And the second they get bored, it's kind of like, okay, we could rework this, or this isn't clear, or this goes on too long. It's like we have those discussions, but it's never about like the overall length. This has to be 45 minutes. This has to be 35 minutes.
Right. Except there's one, the studio I know has a contractual deal with, our show that has to deliver a certain amount of minutes overall for a season. But that never has really had to play into anything in terms of like the lengths of individual episodes. As Jeff said, it's whatever feels right. Sometimes a scene doesn't work in one episode and you move it to another episode and it magically fits in, and it doesn't matter that one episode just got 3 minutes shorter, another one got 3 minutes longer.
Most of these shows are like 48, 52 minutes long. What were the first cuts?
We're coming from pre-planning a lot of previs. At least in my experience with my cuts, they were not super fat. They were a couple minutes here and there probably, because you're trying to include everything just to make sure that it's playing. But because we were so involved so early, the cuts were already evolving before we even shot. Having that much lead time helped the overall process later. So you weren't just chucking things out because they didn't work anymore. You were already had a head start.
An interesting phenomenon though, with when you are cutting previs, is because it's still cartoon actors, they're not quite doing what their live action actors do. So even though you've honed the script and it's like tight and it's working, in the end, it's almost, it gets 25% longer once the actors come in and do their business and do, move, walk from one area to another, whereas that all happened in a few frames on previous. So they tend to get longer afterwards. But as far as content, they're usually pretty, they're not that far off.
Yeah. I like to make my previs move fairly quickly, especially when I do my Mando performances, when I record my voice and put it in all of the characters. I intentionally read things fairly quickly, so it's not like you're sitting there watching somebody trying to perform to an animated version. You know what I mean? It's like we show the story, but it's quick. The only thing that the previs really does on set is, first of all, they can see exactly where the camera can go because they've designed the previs sets exactly the way they're going to be in real life. And they have these things called virtual scouts where they go in with virtual glasses and they sit in the virtual set. So the director and the producers can sit there and they can look around and they can see, okay, that's what that's going to look like from that angle. This is this prop and everything's to scale and everything's built. So they all know what is going to happen on the day in terms of geography. But then things change. Everything gets more creative and more collaborative and everything starts moving and they shoot it differently and they perform it differently and they do it like this. But when they're shooting, say, for instance, the actors inside of a cockpit of a spaceship that's going down canyon wall and getting chased by TIE fighters, well, they're not going to shoot the TIE fighters in the canyon wall in the spaceship, but they're going to shoot the actors. So that's where the previews comes in handy.
And on a set, it serves as like a shot list for the cameraman and for the directors. They can, they look at the cut and they go, oh yeah, that's right. We need that angle. That's right. We need, you know, and it's just a reminder.
It's interesting that you pointed out somebody can sit in a virtual world that you see everything, but then when you shoot, that has to be rendered differently. And that's why the previous has to be done, because it's a higher quality render than what those people are seeing in the virtual glasses.
The wall has much more fidelity so that it looks photographic, and it's got certain level of animation. In the VR world, sometimes things are moving and animated, but sometimes it's just kind of all still because they haven't decided what area you're looking at. And then once that's decided based on the VR scout and the previs edit, you've honed it on this particular portion of the world, and that's up-resed and animated and made to look as real as possible. And there's always been an effort to keep as much of the backgrounds that are shot all the way through and not change them, not touch them up, because if you can make it look great and make it usable, why not?
And as the process matures with the volume, they are taking advantage of more animations in the background. So rather than just be like rear screen projection, now there's things happening outside a cockpit or someone walking on a platform in the background. It's fun to watch.
This wasn't on Rescue, but on John's episode that I cut on the Marshall, in the background there are banthas moving, and you can sit on set and you're just watching them, and they're doing their cycles, and it's like, it looks real. It's pretty amazing.
Who worked with Bryce Dallas Howard?
That was me and Eric.
Is there a difference between working with a director who is a director slash actress and a director slash writers? Do they collaborate differently?
Coming from that actor side of things, similar to John, she has a really a great understanding of what the actors can do, what they can bring, what they need when they're on set. She's always thinking about that when she, down from when she gets the initial script in through previs, putting little notes in, because obviously the previs guys can only go so far with what they do. So we'll put little notes in to remind everybody, hey, we're looking for this, or this is this kind of emotion. And then once they get on set, she's very open to collaboration with the actors. Once they get in and they're looking, well, this blocking doesn't work the way we thought it would, or my character wouldn't do that. So it's those kinds of things where she's, I think, really excels.
Does she collaborate with you in post more like the way you might imagine a director collaborates with an actor?
Not in terms of what's my motivation for a cut there, but definitely what's the motivation of the scene? What's the important beats? But the same thing I think the director coming from that side of things would ask as well.
I find Bryce to be extremely hands-on and very detail-oriented, actually.
Yeah.
And once she's in post, she seems to be very, very precise about what she wants. And
how does sound design play into the pacing of picture editing?
Sound is extremely important, and it's extremely important in that sequence that I pulled a clip for. It's the climax of the episode when Mando and Ahsoka have basically teamed up. You know, it's the final showdown with Ahsoka and the Magistrate, and Mando with her loyal guard, Lang, outside in the outer courtyard. Of course, as I talked about earlier, Dave Filoni was very inspired by Kurosawa, the movie called Yojimbo in particular, that has a very similar style. So I'm going to talk about visual as well as sound, because that dictated the pace as well. He was not afraid to go with these very big wide shots and let them play out. Let the women walk toward each other in a wide shot without cutting to their faces right away, without being always tight. This was a standoff. It was all about the sound of the laser swords and the Beskar hitting each other. And it was all about the quietness in the outer courtyard where all the guys could hear. There was nothing but a little bit of wind, and all they could hear was what was going on in that inner courtyard between the two women. And that sound had to be played very delicately and played with perspective in a certain way so that we felt that we were with them listening to this fight going on in the courtyard, and they could tell what was going on in the fight based on what they were hearing. The sound was very precise, how we choreographed or edited the fight to hit certain beats. We were trying to tell a story with sound and the visuals.
While we're on this scene, talk to me about that inner cutting. Was the inner cutting the same as the script?
Well, in this particular episode, that fight had not been choreographed yet. It had not been previs at all. The only part that had been previs was the outer part with the two guys, which was very much shot and edited even in previs like a classic Western. But the outer fight was just a title on the screen saying Ahsoka and the Magistrate fight. Dave wanted me down on the set. This was really the only time on that episode that Dave, you know, really needed me down there. Sort of cut as they went along, just so he could sort of see how it was all going to start coming together. But I have to say that on that day, I was really only focusing on their fight. I wasn't focusing on the intercut. And, you know, between me taking my first stab at it and then John and Dave sitting down with me and weighing in and working things out and going, you know, maybe we should have this, maybe we should have that. Maybe they, you know, maybe we cut out this whole part of that fight and just go straight from here to here. That's all a collaboration between me and the producers and the director.
Got it. Episode 15.
Is that, do you mean 16?
Is it 16? Maybe that is 16. Yeah, it must be 16. Of course it's 16. Yeah, 16. I noticed about a third of the way through the episode, there's really two missions going on. The Mandalorian is going on one mission and the rest of the team is trying to execute another mission at the same time. Let's talk about the intercutting going on between the people of the bridge at the end and the fight that's happening on the way to the bridge.
That was actually one of the biggest challenges, was to orchestrate this, not only the cross-cutting, but there's a big reveal of a legacy character at the end of this episode. And that's a huge moment for the show, for Star Wars in general, but that's story-wise not the most important part of the episode and of the season. The important part is Mando and the kid and him letting him go and to go with this Jedi. First of all, how John wrote the episode and then how we structured the rhythm of the cross-cutting had to lead up to that moment. That was something that we were very conscious of in how long we're on Mando, you know, going to the bridge, how long we're on the other Mandos clearing the way, when we take a moment with Moff and Mando in their fight, then when the X-Wing comes in, and everything had to unfold the cards one more, even just in the last moments where the Jedi is making his way to the bridge, also how we reveal that. You have a hooded figure, then you have a black and white image of a lightsaber. It was all very purposeful and orchestrated to reveal this character, and then that just be the setup for the main emotional thread of the episode, which is him coming to take the kid. And the moment between Mando when he takes off his helmet willingly to look face to face with Grogu, and the moment between them, which was the climax of the episode and the emotional heart of the episode and of both seasons leading up to that moment.
Did you guys edit this through the pandemic? How did you manage editing remotely, technically?
Yeah, I mean, we finished shooting 3 days before the full lockdown. It was crazy. So the entire post, once shooting stopped, was pandemic. So we were trying to be innovative how we even did, as I'm sure every other show going at the same time was.
And they were telling us, get ready for the long haul. This is going to be forever. And I'm like, come on, man. We're going to be
2 weeks.
Be off for 2 weeks. I don't even need to bring a drive home. What are you guys talking about? Meanwhile, literally almost a year and a half later, I finally got all of my toys and pictures from my office delivered to my house.
The IT guys were very proactive. They, a month before, when people really doubted this could ever happen, were already getting their ducks in a row and sort of planning out what could happen in case. And so we really were ready on a dime. Like within 2 days, they had everybody's houses set up with security, equipment, everything that we needed to move forward. And we really barely missed a beat. We all kind of fell into the Zoom review world quicker than we'd like, but we did.
Yeah, I don't think there was a single day that we were down. I remember taking my drive home on Tuesday, and on Wednesday morning, I was at home working.
Big shout out to Zach Vine, who works with us as an assistant, and he just figured out how to have us all working. There's a few growing pains, but we're able to work seamlessly using shared projects with bin locking and everything. And we got used to working where we have to wait a little bit, but I think everyone appreciates it.
Compared to getting spare bins and media, not even close.
You know, I was comparing notes with some friends of mine on other movies at different studios. And we were much further ahead of the curve than they were at the time. Not all the studios were as ready to change on a dime. And so they had longer learning curves and transitions than we did.
And then we also had to do our mix and DIs from home. When we first went home, we're like, yeah, we'll be, like Jeff said, we'll be back. But then we quickly realized, no, we're not. We have to do all our visual effects reviews and our final mix review at home, which for our show in particular, I think was actually a benefit because it's a streaming show. Everybody's seeing it in different environments. We all had our own headsets that were all sanctioned from Skywalker so that it was like everyone's listening to the same thing, but we could take them off and listen to it in our own home setups just to say, oh, you know, let's just see how it sounds different and be able to actually bring that different environment to the mix and not, this is pristine, this is how it sounds on the stage, but yet no one's ever going to hear it this way. It was actually kind of a benefit, I think.
Have any of you guys monitored in anything other than stereo or by LCR?
I've done 7.1 when we did Guardians of the Galaxy 2. We were in full-on editing mode with all of our tracks and all the speakers and every person's room separated out. It's much easier than you'd think, actually.
Adam doesn't go anywhere without at least a 5.1.
at least a 5-1.
We had an edit van set up on set, and he insisted at least 3 speakers on this edit van. He needed the LCR on the van. I think I
should. the Vandalorian.
Yeah. I love sound so much, and sound design is like one of my favorite things in the world. And I love being able to work so closely with the sound designers and editors after my episode is done, before we show the directors, to just like get it to where I think it sounds the best, you know, because that's one of my favorite processes. But I've never been a big, let me put all my speakers up and do 5-1. If I could, I would, but I would waste 3 times as much time just tinkering with the surround sound if I had that opportunity. So now the fact that I can lay down dope sound effects and just not worry about it, and it's in stereo and it's loud, I'll let the professionals handle it, because otherwise I would never get any editing done. I'd spend so much time on the sound.
It is a little less important on a show like this, but when you are working on a movie that you know is going to be played pretty much exclusively in a theater, and you have things happening behind you and it's almost part of the storytelling, it really helps to have that, especially when you're doing screenings, things for your directors, producers, and even a test audience. So working that way is really beneficial. And it takes less time than you think.
Any specifics about the Believer scene where Mandalorian takes off his helmet and they're kind of in this confrontation, kind of in a lunchroom? I don't know what else to call it, right? Can you talk a little bit about just developing that? There was definitely a tension. You knew something was going to break. You knew something was going to happen in that scene.
One of my favorite things about that scene is that I got faces. A lot of times on the show, you're cutting a dude in a mask and a puppet and another dude in a mask. And then maybe you have one person with a face who doesn't really say as much or have as big a port, or they're just in the background, right? Pedro's great. And the guy that played Hess, I can't remember his name right now. He's terrific. I mean, everything he's in, he's a badass. Shockingly, Bill Burr is incredible. He's a brilliant dramatic actor. And he nailed it every single freaking take. And the fun thing about that is that you've got this tug of war between what the two guys are saying. And neither of them are trying to poke the other guy too hard, but they're still trying to poke the other guy. And so what's fun about that is that because of faces, you get to cut to Mando, who's essentially the main character of this story, of this scene. And you get to see on his face what's going on between the two guys. And he's trying to keep it calm. Meanwhile, Bill Burr's still poking the guy and the other guy's not taking it. And they shot this in such a way that, you know, we had a tight and a wide and a medium and a low, you know what I mean? And you could play with the sizes to say who's got the power in the scene. And then the slow creep-ins towards the end, which totally tell you that somebody's about to explode, right? And so playing with a scene like that was so fun, because you really can build and manipulate the tension with the timing and the looks and who you cut to when and what size you use. And that was probably the most fun about that scene. That's why I chose that episode, obviously, for the submission. I come from a comedy background, so I always love to take the air out of a scene with a little bit of a laugh. Turns out Rick loves that too. We're both huge fans of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark action scenes. And there's always this building tension in every single scene that comes to a head, and then you kind of poof, take the air out with a joke. So as soon as Hess gets shot, that stormtrooper that just stops, you know, dead, it's almost like like you get to kind of like release your breath before it starts all over again. Even in the previs, one of my favorite things was the sound of that metal tin cup just rolling across the floor forever while everybody just looks like, what the hell? That's one of my favorite things to do, is like after the action scene, it's like builds to attention. You just kind of suck the air out of it.
I could see how, because it's a puppet, essentially, that you have to be very careful with finding those perfect moments where it looks realistic, where there's a sense of emotion. Can you talk to me about looking at that footage to find those right moments?
Well, the puppeteers are pretty incredible, and you're dealing with another actor. You get dailies of the puppet. It's not just a static thing that you figure out later. They're doing emotion. They're moving the eyes. They're moving the face, the ears. Everything is going. And you're looking for the best moments. For example, in the scene in the end of The Rescue where Mando is with the kid and he's in his arms and you've got those looks to Mando, kid's bringing it just as much as Pedro is. And it's really great to be able to cut with those emotional, you know, with that emotion footage, and you're not trying to imagine what's there. You're actually seeing it, you know, a testament to the puppeteers that are operating. It's not just one. I don't know, was it like 3 or 4 guys that are actually...
I think 3 or 4.
Yeah. Some guys who have, there's different puppets that some have rods, some are remote control. There's various ways they can move the baby depending on what the scene is that they have to shoot or if he's walking or not walking.
Those little moments really pop out. I remember putting together a little reel for Dylan for when the baby was playing in the soup. And, you know, there's just these great little like, oh, that's so cute. I mean, it really touches.
Well, in season one, it would ask me how much of it is CG and how much of it is puppet. And they're expecting me to say like, it's mostly CG or whatever. And I said, guys, it's like, it's 99% puppet. If it had to do something that it just couldn't do, they would have some CG enhancement perhaps. But this was puppet. This what you're looking at on this show is a live puppet.
And we tried to stay away from things it couldn't do. You know, like there was an effort to not have it run across the room because it couldn't do that. So you want it to be as real as it could be.
I remember first season when they were first filming the baby, I went down to set and I was just kind of looking around. It was also in a volume set. I had no idea it was a volume until I actually stepped on it. I was like, oh my God, they didn't build any of this. Everybody was kind of on break and they were moving around and the baby was sitting there on the set in his pram. And I went over there very slowly and I just like looked at it and the puppeteers were watching me and I didn't notice. And as soon as I came up to it, the baby's eyes looked up at me and he went over like this. And I just, I got shocked. I got scared, but it was like, I was just like, it took me like a beat to go, oh my God, you guys are watching me. And they're all sitting back there laughing. I was just like, man, I about had the most magical moment. And that was before the baby was even on TV yet, you know, and it was still like, oh my God, right there in front of me.
All right, guys. Well, I love that story. That's pretty funny. Thank you so much. I know you guys are all editing and have other projects that you're working on, things you got to get to.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. Also, it's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut: Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guests, Dylan Fershein, Eric Chesson, Andrew S. Eisen, ACE, Jeff Siebenek, and Adam Gerstel. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition, and thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish, and so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. Have you ever reviewed a podcast? I'd love to hear your review of this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.